Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome back to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford, and I'm the blessed guy who gets to be the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith church in Sacramento, California. As always, I'd love you to zip over to the website. It's epiclesis.org, E-P-I-C-L-E-S-I-S.org, to learn at least a little more about this thing called ancient future Christian faith. On this program brought to you each week by Epiclesis, right here on KFIA Radio, we love to bring you a variety of guests to talk about, well, what in the world is ancient future faith? We bring you, goodness, pastors and theologians and academicians, all kinds of folks to talk about this thing. And today it's an extra pleasure to bring to you someone local, someone who is also a pastor. Welcome to the program today, Nathan Oates. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks.
So, Nathan, you are a pastor of Emmaus Church Community in the Lincoln area,
right?
That's right. Okay, so tell us a little bit about it, and then I want to get to know you a little better with some questions about you.
Okay, we were invited out in 2004 to begin a new church in the area and launched the project officially in 2005. We were fascinated by the idea of starting a community that would be rooted around transformational spiritual experiences.
I'm going to want to talk to you about that. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Sure. So that caused us to reach deeper into the historical church than our short history as a denomination. We're part of the Church of the Nazarene, which has about a 100-year history.
Right.
We also wanted to develop a church that was real focused on developing community. We talked about raising kids intentionally together, sharing life together, and then ultimately wanted to engage the culture through the lens of compassion. So we talk about sharing life and discovering Jesus and restoring all things.
Who or what led, apart from the Holy Spirit, who or what led you to Lincoln in particular? You said you were invited out. I'm just curious about that.
Right. I was serving as a youth pastor here in Sacramento
for
6 years in a Nazarene church.
I see.
And the district superintendent, which serves sort of an overseer of a group of churches, in our case about 60, invited us to plant a new church within the denomination in Lincoln.
Nathan, I do want to get back to this notion of transformational activity. Transformational is a word that you used a lot in describing your church, and I'm itching to ask you more about that. But first, though, just take a couple of minutes to tell us, well, everything we need to know about you so folks can get to know you a little better.
Okay. I love the local church. I'm convinced that it's the hope of the world. I grew up in this area, went to school elsewhere, and then kind of have come back home. I have three children, all living at home from 8 to 16, a great wife, and enjoy being outside and spend a lot of time in books.
Well, we have that in common anyway. I barely go outdoors, but I do love my books a lot. And you've been serving at Emmaus Church since 2005, right?
That's right. At Easter, we just celebrated our 13th birthday.
Oh, that's marvelous. Hey, you said something a minute ago about transformational and looking backward. I'd like to hear more about that because it sounds like you and I are on the same kind of railroad track and we're interested at least in some similar things with regard to ancient future faith.
Yeah, for sure. I think I was exposed to a depth of Christian faith in college and in graduate school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Wheaton College.
Oh, okay.
In the graduate school there.
Oh, that's right. That's where you kind of at least rub shoulders with Bob Weber.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So there was the introduction to like a reality that came before the Reformation. Mm. You know, I just had never heard of that before. So I was exposed to church fathers and ancient practices of faith. And then I think that it kind of hit the point of application when, as a youth pastor, I ran up against just the practical challenges of the idea of a changed life. I'll use this quote from Kenda Creasy Dean. She says that in one of her books, the church is pretty good at behavior modification, but it stinks at transformation. And that really resonated when we started the church. And so that became kind of a touchstone for us. We ordered our early liturgy around this priority of transformational experiences. We didn't want to just go through anything that maybe seemed common or traditional, but wasn't ultimately rooted in the desire to change a life.
Hmm. So I'm going to go out on a limb here, but assume that you also see the corporate worship experience when the body comes together as transformational. What kind of things are you looking for in worship? And are you intentional about in worship with regard to this transformational idea?
Sure. So a couple ideas right out of the gate. The typical evangelical worship experience is ultimately rooted in kind of a American revivalist pattern, where there's a long warm-up to the speaker climaxes in this moment of decision, and then 6 seconds later, you're outside in the parking lot, which has its role when you're an evangelist, right? It has its purpose and it serves it. I respect and honor that.
But and that would be something that a lot of our listeners will be familiar with, because if they're like me, or grew up in the Baptist church, that's exactly what our template was.
Yeah, almost every American church follows that essential pattern of worship. So we discovered or were introduced to this fourfold pattern of worship, which we embraced from the beginning because of our value on transformation. So that, briefly said, is a call to worship, the delivery of the word. So often when people come to our church, they're surprised that we're preaching within the first 10 minutes. I mean, we're up there preaching. And then the bulk of the gathering follows and is a response to the delivery of the word,
including
a response in communion. So typically a Nazarene church has a high view of communion, but probably isn't celebrating communion every week. We, from the beginning, decided we would do so.
That's an important priority, at least in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know how the folks from the beginning attached themselves or were attracted to this particular vision or found it compatible or at least idiomatic with what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And or how is it to communicate that to folks who are coming along behind them now? Is it something that people are embracing?
That's a really good question. I think initially we were attracting people who were committed to Christ but frustrated with the more common church experience. And so almost anything new but rooted in a worked through philosophy seemed attractive to them because the only real philosophy of ministry that most were introduced to was culturally rooted. Think culturally about the church and do things that make sense to the culture. So the idea that we would think theologically about the church was a new idea to many.
And attractive.
It was attractive.
In the best sense of the word.
I agree, because it felt deep. It felt like it lasted and had been around longer than the newest kind of trend.
Whatever's the latest thing.
Mm-hmm. And the other big group of people that joined in with us were people who were just seeking God, wouldn't even declare themselves to be Christians yet. And they, of course, didn't have the framework of understanding how what we were doing was different than what is often done. But they felt drawn into our emphasis on intentional community. I think they felt like if you're going to be a religious person, if you're going to consider how you might wrap your life around God, it makes sense that it should impact your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And the primary way that it affects your lifestyle is through the relationships and how you treat people.
Quick story. I suppose the assumption is among many these days doing church that folks who are not church or are pre-believers or young believers need all this other stuff sort of stripped away before they can kind of get a handle on what's going on in worship. And I remember early on at Epiclesis, our church, there was a middle-aged woman who had come to us from a very large charismatic church with very little liturgy of any kind. And I remember feeling a little worried that maybe all this would be overwhelming or whatever. And I asked her I pulled her aside and said, tell me, is this stuff intimidating or are you finding your way along? And she went, oh, no, I'm so grateful for the liturgy. She said, because it carries me along and it helps me to say and pray what I cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some comfort in that, don't you?
I agree. Yeah, some of the things that are initially difficult for people, like consistent confession of sin or a weekly challenge to pass peace to one another, or even phrases that sound strange like Lord have mercy, begin after a while, I think, to really take root and take hold and begin to shape you, begin to transform you. And so you see after a while that discomfort shifts into a conviction that, oh man, I'm actually changing. I'm actually becoming a different person. So now I see the value here, and can I please have more?
Oh, that's wonderfully said. The medieval church had a phrase that roughly translated is the rule of worship is the rule of faith. Or said another way, as Bob Weber used to say, show me what you sing, show me how you worship, and I'll tell you what you believe. Because worship will be transformational for better or for worse.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Folks, you are listening to an interview with Pastor Nathan Oates. He is the pastor at Emmaus Church Community in the Lincoln area, been there since 05. And we're talking today about ancient future faith. and more particularly his church. And I'm excited about this part of the interview because he's going to go off on a sabbatical soon. Nathan, first of all, God bless you. I'm just excited for you to be able to go off on a sabbatical. Is this the first one in your ministerial career?
No, actually, it'll be the second, which I realize is a big blessing. When we started the church, a friend of mine, just a brief backstory there, is a friend of mine who had been exposed to the church for years, grew up in the church, and then got involved in parachurch ministry pretty heavily. He saw the constant fallout of unhealthy pastors and the ramifications on the church. And so when he knew that we were starting a church and felt like, wow, that's pretty much a suicide mission, he said, I want to support a sabbatical fund for your church. So, give us $20,000 the year we started so that we could begin to have an actual sabbatical fund. And so I took a sabbatical after 7 years. Another staff member took one after 7 years. And now I'm up for my second, having served there for 14.
Marvelous. Well, I want you to tell us a little bit about what your plans are. And then here's the long range plan for me. I also want to interview you when you come back from this wonderful trip so we can kind of get a before and after. But I'm anxious to hear how this particular trip was transformational for you. Launch out. Would you tell us what's coming up? Why in the world have you chosen this particular thing? And tell us a little bit about it.
I think there's a couple of hopes. The first and primary is just that we get some time to spend with our children and to rest and to take a break from the daily challenges of ministry within the church context. So I want to prioritize that. So my family and I, because we've dreamt about it for a long time, we'll spend some time in Italy, looking around, seeing some different cities there. I also learned through work with a spiritual director that one of the ways I am renewed is through learning. And so whereas some pastors are going to want to just set the books down during a time of sabbatical, that would be terrible for me.
Yeah, me too.
I want to pick up the books because I am literally, I'm renewed through learning. And so that's an important personal discovery to both make and accept as valid. Consequently, the second half of our time away, I will actually be spending in a monastery with Benedictine monks in the birthplace of Saint Benedict, which is a place called Nursia, Italy.
Oh my goodness gracious. How did you put this thing together? How did you cobble it together? Did somebody help you?
Yeah, absolutely. I met a Dominican nun named Sister Maximilian Marie. There's a house, a Dominican house in Loomis, and we met. And she connected me to the abbot, ultimately, at the monastery in Nursia.
Okay, so you're getting ready for this trip. When is it again, by the way?
It's this summer.
Okay, so it's coming soon, and there's going to be a family component to it, but then you're going to go off, I assume, by yourself.
Correct.
And spend how long and what in the world are you going to do all of that time at a Benedictine monastery?
Well, it'll be 3 weeks, and I really can't answer the second question. I can imagine it being somewhere between, there's the guest house, we'll see you at dinner, and what I hope is the latter, which is more like, here's your job, and here are the prayer times to which you'll be welcome, and here's the monks that we've kind of assigned to you as potentially companions for this time. I really don't know. I've only done weekends at monasteries, and they pretty much leave you alone.
Right.
But for 3 weeks, I'm hoping I can integrate into the community a little more completely. At the minimum, I hope to just get a real life, because all I know about Benedictine spirituality is from books. So I really need to see it in action in order to figure out how to translate it to a non-monastic community like our church.
I want to get back to that notion as well, because I think that's a terribly important fallout or consequence of your trip. But you said several things there that point to rhythm of life and daily life. You said a job and what else? Activities and assigning you to some monks and so on. So tell us a little bit about what the rhythm of a daily community like that is going to be. And you mentioned, gosh, prayer times during the day. So they're praying more than once a day, and, and you're going to be integrated into those. Tell us a little bit about the rhythm of community life.
Yeah, my understanding from the rule of St. Benedict is that there's essentially three parts of the day. There's the divine reading, and then there's the corporate prayer time. And then the third part is the work, the manual labor, the digging in the garden. And all three of these complement one another and become one big act of worship. And so it's very simple, but it is regimented. And to your question, yes, they pray seven times a day. And when the bells chime, indicating a change, the rule makes it very clear. There's no hesitation. You prefer nothing over prayer, but all of life is prayer. And so you just, in submission to the order, put your tools down and go sing the Psalms. And then when they're done, you go back out and pick your tools up and continue to work. And that's really fascinating to me because what is the word? I see them as different most of the time in my
life.
Yeah,
sure. Well, we compartmentalize our lives,
don't
we?
That's the word. That's what I was looking for.
And that same word came to my mind a few minutes ago when you said some pastors would love the idea of putting the books down. Mm-hmm. Oh, golly, not me. Well, some books. There are some books that I need to put down. But as odd as this may sound to folks, pastors do an awful lot of reading and praying about what's going to happen at church.
Right.
But sometimes we neglect our own spiritual life and reading, for lack of a better word, for ourselves.
Right. During our first sabbatical, we had some real insight that was given to us, which is essentially that in order to be renewed, my wife needed to spend time with people. I didn't want to spend time with people, but she did in order to be renewed. And so we needed to prioritize that. In a similar way, I needed to continue to read and write. She didn't want me to, but when she realized that that was just core to my renewal, she, of course, embraced it and supported it. So I think it depends on literally the personality and the strengths mix of the individual in regard to what could be a helpful and healthy sabbatical experience. I think you need to take a break and step away as a practice of submission of your work to the Lord. And then in terms of personal renewal, I think you need to do whatever it is that renews you.
It occurs to me that you mentioned along the way there that one of the things you hope to do is bring some of this good stuff back to your own church. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick your brains about that here in just a minute. But first, let me remind folks that they're listening to an interview with my new friend, Pastor Nathan Oates. He is the pastor of Emmaus Church Community in Lincoln. And we're going to give you all the information about how you can see more from them, their website, that kind of thing, learn more about them and their services and all the activities that are happening there. But Pastor Nathan is in the studio today talking with us about ancient future faith and how that has collided with his ministry and enhanced it. And then also, most particularly, a sabbatical trip that he's going to take this summer, partly with family and partly all by his lonesome, which again sounds like heaven to me, and I'm envious. To a Benedictine monastery in Italy. Mm-hmm. Pastor Nathan, you're going to go and you're going to pray and you're going to sing and you're going to work and you're going to read and you're going to immerse yourself in the life of this community. Mm-hmm. What's some stuff you're hoping to bring back to your own church community?
There's so much that I just hope to observe. Big picture, I hope to observe the rule of Saint Benedict lived out.
What do you mean by that, really?
Well, this is a way of expressing devotion to Jesus that was written in Italy in the 6th century. So we're a long ways away from the vision that was cast by Benedict in his time. And so I'm curious to know, do they still do this? To what degree do they adhere to the rule? And how have they adapted it because of the change in culture and time? Yeah, and then more specifically, I'm really interested. There's three vows that Benedictine monks make, and the first is the vow of stability, and that's kind of emerged in my mind and heart as a real point of conviction, of frustration, of interest. And essentially, in his original context, it meant that you would remain committed to a specific monastery and a specific abbot or leader for your whole life. I was captivated by the first line of the first chapter in Benedict's rule. The first time I read it, he says this. He says, clearly there are four kinds of monks. And I was just like, oh, really? Clearly? This is fascinating. And one of the four that he describes in no uncertain terms as terrible, he just is absolutely put off by this way of being a monk, is what he calls a gyrovag. And this is a monk that will just show up at a place, receive amazing hospitality, and just before they'll ask him to actually carry some weight, he's off to the next.
Yeah, right.
And he just kind of shops monasteries and takes advantage of the beautiful. I mean, the monasteries would treat visitors as Christ. And so you're going to be treated really well if you come and visit a monastery. And I think that, Chris, this really put some interesting language to what has long been a frustration of mine as a leader of a church in a culture where people really don't think of church as a place of commitment.
Right. I
mean, we treat the church, generally speaking, more like a phone service than as a family. We'll drop it in a heartbeat if somebody offers us a better deal. If Verizon's got a cheaper deal, I'm dropping AT&T tomorrow, right? And it's like we've missed the idea of church as community. We treat it more like a commodity. And if you can help me, I'll take it.
Yeah.
What are you doing for me?
What do you got today?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've reversed the direction 180 degrees of this idea of a worship service. It used to be something that we did unto the Lord. And I literally, as recently as this last week in another context, heard someone say, this is our service to you, to the guests. And I loved their thinking and their hospitality, but we refer to a church service and we think of it as something that we get from, not as something that is being done out of devotion to Jesus. So that's a long way of getting to this idea of stability.
Oh, I think that's critical.
That's what I hope to bring back is this specific monastery in Nursia was destroyed. It was a 12th century monastery that was destroyed a couple years ago in an earthquake. Most of Nursia was completely destroyed. People literally left. The electricity, the water was all disrupted. However, the Benedictine monks opted to stay.
Yeah.
And this is rooted in their value and in their vow of stability. And it's not as simple as I'm going to be on the same piece of property for my whole life. It's deeper than that.
Sure.
It's this value of consistency and endurance and perseverance and the insight that comes over the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm interested in. This is what I believe could be integrated into a modern, non-cloistered community, something like our church, as a way forward, as a guiding light to how can we actually impact this city in the name of Jesus by being a people who are marked by stability.
If we could just get that thing right there, how it would transform our churches.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story about one of the Desert Fathers receiving a young inquirer, young seeker, who wanted to learn the meaning of life or something like that. And the old wizened Desert Father refused to see him except after a year. And finally, the guy comes into the Desert Father and says, I've been waiting a year. Aren't you going to say something to me? And he said, I think that you need to wait another year. Yeah. And evidently this plays out over several years until the guy finally got it. So I'm with you there on this notion of stability. So that's one. You got one more that you're hoping to bring back?
I think that's the primary focus of the research project or of kind of what I'll be looking for while I'm there. You can't ultimately separate stability from the other two vows, which are ongoing conversion and obedience. And so together they all complement one another and overlap. But without freaking people out, specifically in our church community in Lincoln, I do wonder what we could learn from such a intentional community of transformation, such as a Benedictine monastery, and how we might be able to translate these 1,500-year-old vows and practices into our context in order to make a deeper, not a flashy, impressive splash on a short-term sort of flash in the pan, but maybe make a deeper impact on the long-term transformation of our town.
Oh, golly, you're singing my song. What a pleasure to have you with us today to talk about these things. Hey, I got an idea.
All right.
Nathan, when you come back from this trip and after you've had a little while to unpack a little bit, both physically and emotionally and spiritually, let's get together and talk about it again, okay? Because I want to debrief you and I want to hear all about this trip. And then I can see us even continuing to revisit this over the course of the next few months to see how it's impacting not only your church, but golly, you've got something to share with all of us here in the Sacramento area about these important things. Will you do that? Will you come back?
I'd love to. Thank you.
Folks, you've been listening to an interview with Nathan Oates. He's the pastor of Emmaus Church Community in Lincoln, and you can find all kinds of information about it by going to emmauscommunity.org. They meet twice on Sunday mornings, 9 and 11, at the Lincoln Theater. Nathan, again, thank you so much for coming. It's been wonderful to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you guys.
So, folks, think about this, would you? Until we gather again for another edition of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to ponder this. Surely, the road to our evangelical future does run through our ancient Christian past. Until next time, the Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at Ancient Future Faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church. And they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience ancient future faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi folks, it's Pastor Chris with one more word before we sign off. The long season after Pentecost is the perfect time to experience worship at Epiclesis, or maybe jump into a small group. There's always something happening at Epiclesis, and we'd love to have you be a part of it. Think about joining us for worship this summer. You'll be warmly welcome. As always, find more information on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next Monday afternoon at 4 p.m. for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.